And we're looking at the sixth chapter of Ecclesiastes. I'm going to read the verses as we come to them, so I won't read the entire passage now. Did you ever drive down Oakland Park? You're going west on Oakland Park, and there's a traffic jam before you get to Power Line. And you say, I'm going to go right up there anyway. I think I'll cut down this way. Before you know it, you're in a dead-end street. A lot of good streets through there, but there's some dead ends, too. I've done it. And you don't come right back out. You stay back there and wait until all the cars that saw you turn have gone, and then you come back out and go up to the end, make your right turn where you're supposed to. But if you aren't careful, you get on dead-end streets. And Solomon is warning us today about getting on some spiritual dead-end streets. One of the spiritual dead-end streets is going to be having to do with money. And so I'm asking as we begin, did you ever stop and think, if I won that lottery, everything would be great. I'd be on easy street the rest of my life. Don't you believe it? No. For the most part, winning the lottery is the worst thing a person can do. I mean, you're talking about big sums of money. You know, $1 here and there, it doesn't matter. But large sums of money ruin people. Melanie and I were in West Virginia a few years back. We stayed at a motel and bought gas at the same place that the guy bought the winning ticket. And he won, several hundred million dollars, a couple hundred million at least. And he was already a rich man. Made a fool out of him. It's just bad. Have you thought about that yourself? What would you do? No, don't tell me, but have you thought about it? No, I'm sure you haven't. Of course you have. Yeah, and I've done it. You know, I said, I'll give money to this mission and to that mission and down the seminary. And I don't know. I hope I would. But do you think I would, maybe? I don't know. Sometimes when you get the money, then it's my money. You know, it can be a problem. Money doesn't solve anything. We learned last week about that. We learned that there are five important things he gives us about money. He says, the more you have, the more you want. The more you have, the more you spend. The more you have, the more you worry. The more you have, the more you lose. And the more you have, the more you leave. Don't take it with you. You know? And then we learned a couple important things about God. God gives us the right to earn money. The ability to earn comes from God. And if he wants us to earn the money, and we allow him to work in our lives, we'll earn the money. And he gives us that right to earn it. He also gives us the ability to enjoy it. Now, in this chapter, he's going to talk about money, but in a negative way. Are you going to tell us what will happen if we try to earn money and enjoy it apart from God? If we do that, then we are, if we do it apart from God, then we're not going to have the desired end that the money could bring. This passage is designed to keep us off those dead-end streets. The first dead-end street is, money won't bring meaning to your life. You think, that's going to be the greatest thing ever happened. Don't think so. And we'll find out what Solomon says. Solomon says in verses 1 and 2, he gives us some insights about that money. He says, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun and is common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires, yet God does not give him the power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity and an evil affliction. Those are his insights. His insights are that a wealth. I think that Solomon is talking here pretty much about himself. He's giving us a little insight into all what happened to him when he got all that money. And he got wealth. Remember what God said to him? God said, ask whatever you want, and I'll give it to you. Whatever? Man. This is the old Aladdin's lamp along the seashore, right? I give you one thing. Tell me one thing you want. That's a little different than the lottery. That's money. I can buy whatever I want. Whatever you want. We've sat around and talked about that. You know, what would you ask? Well, the girl says, would you ask for me or $1 million? He said, ask for $1 million, then I can get you. Well, ask whatever you want, God said to Solomon. And Solomon didn't ask for a lot of money, all that kind of thing. He asked for wisdom and not wealth. And God gave him both. And God said, and this is 2 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 11, and God said to Solomon, because it was in your heart, and you have not asked riches or wealth or honor or the life of your enemies, nor have you asked long life, but you have asked wisdom and knowledge for yourself, that you may judge my people over whom I have made you king. Because of that, I'm going to give you something. I'll give you the wisdom and knowledge, he says. This is how much he received. I'll give you wisdom and knowledge. They're granted to you. And I will give you riches and wealth and honor, such as none of the kings have had who were before you, nor shall any after you have the like. Now, some people, and I've heard this and read it in a lot of commentaries now, oh, look, Solomon was the richest man ever lived. Is that what that says? Don't you read your Bibles? No. He doesn't say that. He says, such as none of the kings who were before you. What kings? The king of Israel. You can't make this context say any more than he's talking about the kings of Israel. How many kings were in Israel before Solomon? Two. Yeah. David, Saul, looking backward. Two. Those two. And any king after you. What king? The kings of Israel. Don't make it, he's richer than anybody in the world today. Maybe so, but that doesn't say that. He says, none of the kings that follow you will be as rich. Now, that was how much he received, but notice his disobedience. His disobedience was that what he was supposed to do, he was supposed to judge God's people wisely, bring honor to God and his life in the nation, not enter into any alliances with the heathen nations, and not to marry any heathen women. That's what he was supposed to do. That's what God told him to do. What did he do? Well, he did some good things. Don't put Solomon down altogether. He did some good things. He built a temple. That temple was beautiful, the most beautiful temple Israel ever had. He was a kind ruler. He built up trade and brought in much money for the nation. It was a rich nation, not just a rich man. That was a rich nation, and the people participated in that as well. He expanded the nation to the greatest point ever, before or since. The kingdom of Israel went a long way, not as far as it's going to in the millennium, but it went a long way. And he did some really great things, but he did some bad things too. He made alliances with the pagan nations. Oh, sure. They all came to him. Oh, what have you got here? You're so wonderful. We'd like to have an alliance with you, okay? Have an alliance. So he made alliances, a lot of alliances with those pagan countries. And God already told them, you know, way back, go back into Numbers, and God said, don't make any alliances with them. Get rid of them. Get them out of there. This is your land. No, he made alliances all over the place. And then he married pagan women. 700 wives. 300 concubines. You imagine? No, I can't imagine that. But he wasn't supposed to do that. And what happened to them was he moved farther and farther away from God and went and worshiped their gods, even made places for them to worship their gods. He went in with them, worshiped their gods. This is the beginning of it, see? Moving farther and farther away from God. One writer wrote, to enjoy the gifts without the giver is idolatry. And that's what he did. He made the things that God had given him idols. And so he had gone a long way down from where God had placed him. Now, the second insight is his insights. Now, his illustrations. He has two illustrations here, comparisons. One is a rich man. And this is where I think you see a thinly disguised self-appraisal of Solomon. He has a rich man. He also has a stillborn child. Which would you rather be? Would you rather be a rich man? If God came to you in the womb and said, which would you rather be? You want to be a rich man and rule over a big country and all? You want to do that, or do you want to be stillborn? Well, he compares the two here. He had great wealth. We talked about that. He says, he's using the illustration. Let me read it, because it's really amazing. He says in verse 3, if a man begets 100 children, I have one. Man has 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed had no burial. I say that a stillborn child is better than he, for it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or anything, this has more rest than the man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, 2,000 years, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place? So he's making this comparison. Now let's kind of unwrap that a little bit. The rich man, he got great wealth. He got a progeny, 100 children. This is his illustration. I don't know how many children Solomon had. With 700 wives and 300 concubines, I don't know. But I know that his son, you say 100 children. Anybody ever have 100 children? I don't know. Maybe. But maybe in Utah somewhere. But whether anybody in the Bible did, I know not. But I know of one. One had 88 children. Did you know that? I didn't know it. Worked on it. 88 children. Rehoboam. Solomon's son, Rehoboam. Here's what it says in 2 Chronicles 11:21. Now Rehoboam loved Micah, the granddaughter of Absalom, more than all his wives and his concubines, for he took 18 wives and 60 concubines and begot 28 sons and 60 daughters. That's called filling up the house with girls so you can get a lot of boys. 60 girls, 28 sons, 88 children. He came close to 100. That's a lot of kids. And then he says, if he had that, had 100 kids. And remember, these things are the things that the Jewish family really wanted. They wanted wealth. They wanted progeny. They wanted long life. And they wanted a proper burial. Those are the things they were really after. Well, the long life. He says, if he lived 2,000 years. Has anybody ever lived that long? No. Who lived the longest? Methuselah. Yeah, 969 years. You know he died before his father did? Think about that. 2,000 years. If he lived 2,000 years, twice as long as Methuselah, and then had no proper burial. Nobody came to his funeral. I remember when Egghead died. You know Egghead. my brother. I wasn't there. I had gone up earlier, and because when a preacher came into his room, he'd say, "Who told you to come here? Get out of here." But then I heard he wanted me. And so I went up there, and I was with him a few days and led him to the Lord. And then I had to leave because I had to get back to college. And he died the next day. He died right after I left. But I wasn't there for the funeral. Well, my brother Ed says, "Boy, you should have seen the cars. They were lined up all the way." that was a thing. It was a thing of pride. There were a lot of people at his funeral. And Solomon says, this man didn't even have a proper burial. What did they do with the thing that put him in the potter field? Or they just throw him off into the junk heap. Just throw the body into the Gehenna. You know? That's all it was. And he said, this man didn't have a proper funeral. So he had all that, but didn't have a proper funeral. There's the rich man, see? That's what he's like. Now, suppose the stillborn. He's talking about the stillborn person, the child. He says, had no meaning. It disappears into darkness. He's forgotten. Well, I guess, you know. What do you remember about somebody? Well, I remember what he used to say. I remember the things he did. You know, the way he said this or what you say about those things. But a child, a stillborn, you know nothing about that. You don't remember him. He never saw the sun. He never knew what life was like. So, there's a comparison. Now, Solomon says, they have a common end. And the common end is, they both go to the grave. And 5 minutes after they're dead, who's better off? They're in the grave. They're both in the grave. What difference does it make? They're both there. So, his thing is, the advantage goes to the baby. Because the baby had more rest, had more freedom from toil and from anxiety and from misery, never dissatisfied with anything, never had anything. And is much better off than that richly blessed person whose soul was never satisfied. No, your money won't bring meaning to your life. Then he says, you won't find joy in your job. Verses 7 to 9. He's not asking, not saying that work is bad, by the way. He's not saying, oh, don't work. If we don't go to work, then things are a mess, you know. You've got to go to work. And he said before, in the previous chapter, he said, work is a gift of God. So it's good because it makes life compelling. It makes you get out of bed in the morning, you know. It gives you fruit of the labor. Things that you do, you know, whatever job you have, there are certain times when you say, man, I did a great job here. And Charles, do you see what I did? Yeah, that's great. We need that. The fruit of our labor. And it teaches us about ourselves. When things don't go exactly right at the work, how do I handle it? Do I handle it, try to handle it myself, or do I let God do it, you know? So I learn about myself from my work. So there's nothing wrong with that, but he's saying that you can't find joy in your job. Because, A, your job can't satisfy your soul. And here's what he says in verse 7. All the labor of man is for his mouth. Keep way of saying it. And yet his soul is not satisfied. What does he do? What is he working for? Well, it's for the stomach, not the soul. It's for the tangible world, not the spiritual world. It pays in the coin of the realm, you know, in the coin of the world. I work in the world, I do a physical job, and I get physical pay. And that buys me food and shelter and clothing, and it's all material. See? And there's no exchange rate between the material and the spiritual. I can't take that and turn it somehow into spiritual. The two worlds are too far apart. The physical job but must not be allowed to shut out the spiritual. See? That's the key. Good to have a job. Must have a job. But don't let that be the aim for which I'm living. See, God created us unto good works, unto spiritual good works, that we should walk in them, says Ephesians 2:10. So your job can't satisfy your soul. Your mind can't replace your heart. He says, for what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have? And who knows how to walk before the living? So the wise man is no better than the fool. And the poor man who knows how to get things done, what about them? Well, your mind, what you know, cannot replace your heart. A wise man with the finest education has no advantage over the fool if God is not the center of his life. At the judgment seat, this may surprise you, but at the judgment seat of Christ, God is not going to ask to see your degree from Dallas or your CPA. Not going to do it. That is not going to happen. He's not going to ask about your scores on the SAT or the GRE or even the FCAT or how well your students did on the FCAT. Not going to count. See? The problem, see, is our work is during the best hours. What are your best hours of the day? Well, from 9 to 5, that's a good time. You know, I'm fresh. I've learned to get here earlier because I kind of peter out toward the end of the day. So I get here earlier, 8 o'clock, and I get things done. Well, that's when work is. And we do the work, working on the job, all those hours, that's the best hours of our life. And the job takes them. Our minds are even on the job even after that, you know. I'm sitting around thinking, boy, that thing that I did, now I know what I can do. Get me a pad. I got to write this down. You know? That's after the hours even. And soon, if you aren't careful, the job takes over our life and requires our very souls. See, Jesus said, the number one commandment is what? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. See? So above that job has to be loving the Lord your God. Work becomes an idol, and that displaces God and displeases God. Working, when you get there at the end of your life, what's it going to be? What are you going to look back on your life and say, this is what my life was? Well, there was a man in England, and his name was Charles Dawson. He discovered the Piltdown Man. You've heard of the Piltdown Man? Well, the Piltdown Man was a discovery by just Charles Dawson of a missing link. We need the missing link, and here he is. And 500 doctoral dissertations were written about that Piltdown Man in about 40 years. Dr. Arthur Keith, there was a Dr. Sir Arthur Woodward, but the Dr. Arthur Keith is also there. He wrote more about the subject than anybody else. He wrote a famous thing, The Antiquities of Man. And he based his lifetime on this one subject, the Piltdown Man. In fact, for 40 years, the Piltdown Man was taught as fact. Little kids in grade school, in junior high school, in colleges, universities, the Piltdown Man was the answer, and it was taught as fact. This will give you a little pause when you look at the science of the day, even today. Here's old Piltdown Man, and Keith was 86 years old, it was discovered that Piltdown Man was a hoax. It was a human skull, orangutan's jawbone, and a dog's tooth. That was the Piltdown. That was the missing link. It wasn't missing anything except the truth. His mind had led him to put faith into a phony fossil and not into a gracious God. So your job can't satisfy your soul, your mind can't replace your heart, and dreams can't replace reality. Verse 9. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. I think this is probably his way of saying a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Got one in the hand, that's the best. Because that's real. That's the real thing. The Proverbs 28:19 says, He who works his land will have abundant food, but the one who chases fantasies will have his fill of poverty. That's what he's talking about. We say to ourselves, when the kids get in school, then we'll get into church. When we get the house paid off, then we'll start saving for retirement. When the kids get out of school, then we'll get involved in the church. You know, we're on the job. You say, well, the next raise, the next promotion, the next assignment, the next transfer, all of that, we keep looking, fantasizing about what's going to happen later on. Now, we need dreams. We need plans, you know. We need to have them. But in the process, we need to stop and enjoy what God has given us, you know. He says, remember, God gives not only the ability to earn money, but the ability to enjoy the money as well. And all this, he says, is vanity and grasping after the wind. So, your money won't bring meaning to your life. You won't find joy in your job. And you won't find answers in your arguments. See, this section deals with the immutability and the inscrutability of God. Like those words? Like those big words. Yeah. Immutability, God can't change. Inscrutability, you can't understand it. It's like the seminarians like to sit around and try to unscrew the inscrutable. Well, you can't do that with God. You can't unscrew the inscrutable God. You can't do that. See, he says, God has ordained life as he desires it. Here's how he says it. Whatever one is, he has been named already, for it is known that he is a man. In other words, your life has been planned. The NET, the New English Translation, says this. Whatever happened was foreordained. Whatever happens to man also was foreknown. You don't like that. That's election. That's the predestination of God. Do you know what? As I thought of this, I thought, man, wouldn't it be great if somebody said, I want to know about that. I want to study that. I'd love it. I used to do this. I taught all week, and I worked a part-time job sometimes. Then on a Saturday night, the students asked me during the week, well, we'd like to know more about this. I said, oh, great. Let's go do it. So on Saturday night, we met in the cafeteria. Somebody made a pot of coffee. The girls made some cookies. And had a great crowd there, a large group there. And we began to start to talk. And we said, we did this three or four times. One time, I started about 7 o'clock, finished up about 2 a.m. Still, I mean, we talked. We stopped a little bit, have some coffee and cookies. And then we go back at it and ask some more questions. That's good. And I would do that in a minute. If someone said, I want to study this, I want to get together, we'll sit down at a table and we'll go for it. Sunday night, Wednesday night, whatever night you want. Come in the afternoon. Well, what I'm saying is that we need to see God as where he is and what the Bible says about what he does. Well, he created horses to gallop gracefully. He created eagles to fly spectacularly and fish to swim effortlessly. And he made man purely for himself. God's special companions. Isn't that great? You think of that way? God created us to be fellowshipping with him. God came, remember, he came and walked in the garden and he talked with Adam and fellowshiped with them, Adam and Eve. Yeah, that's what it was for. That's what it was all about. And then everything fell. But he's still working on that. And he's saving people out of the out of their dull, humdrum lives, out of sin. He's saving them to be fellowshipping with him. Not just later on sometime, but now. Right now, he wants fellowshipping with us. See? We are his companions. And if we try to live any other way, then it's like horses trying to fly, eagles trying to gallop, and we're just like fish out of water. If we try to do it not God's way. God has ordained life as he desires it. But arguing, he said also, arguing with God is an exercise in futility. He cannot contend with him who is mightier than he is. Okay? What he's saying is it's useless to argue with God. God is stronger. God is omnipotent. God has all power. And God is omniscient. He's smarter than we are. And so if you are going to try to get him into some kind of a discussion, Norm the philosopher, Dallas. Who? No. Geisler, Norm Geisler. I told somebody one day, I wouldn't argue with Norm Geisler about my name, even though it's the same as it. Because Norm Geisler just hits like that, just a shotgun. Well, try that with God. You try arguing with God and see what happens. It's not only useless, it's illogical to argue with God. Paul says it this way. He says, when somebody said to him, he's raising an objection, saying, well, who has resisted his will? Why does God yet find fault? You know what Paul says? Shut up. That's basically what he says. See, he does it a little better than I did. But he says this. Indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him that formed it, why have you made me like this? Does not the potter have power over the clay, from the same lump to make one vessel to honor and another vessel to dishonor? Shut up. You can't talk to God like that. It's illogical for you to find fault with God. He's the one who created you. He's also the one who controls you. He knows what you're going to say. He knows why you say it. Don't try to argue with God. Just accept it, that God has a life ordained for you exactly as he desires it. Now, thirdly, God is willing to bring meaning to your life. He doesn't want us wandering around. He doesn't want us sitting around saying, oh, what's going to happen now? And I don't worry about this. And no, he wants to bring meaning to our lives right now. He says this way, since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in his life? All the days of his vain life as he passes through like a shadow. Who knows the best thing for man? What's the answer, class? God. God knows best. And man's experience, he says, is all vanity. Man's experience hasn't helped him at all. Solomon's reflecting on all that he said about all his vanity. I tried this and this, vanity, nothing, emptiness. And that being the case, then, if all that man has doesn't help him in his experience, how much better off is he? He's no better at all. But God knows what's good for man, and only God. Man should follow God's direction. And where do we find that direction? Oh, let's see, I can't think. Where do I find it? Oh, in his word. Yeah, that's where we find it. Now, we don't find it by osmosis. Dr. Mason used to talk about when the Amplified Bible came out. He said, oh, there's a lot of old ladies just sleeping with that thing under their pillow. You don't learn sleeping with under your pillow. Right? What you learn, well, you learn it by reading it, by getting into it. Well, the we learn his word. And so only God knows what's good for man. Let's find out what it is. Let's find in his word what it is. What it is for me, especially, and I'll find it there if I look. Now, finally he says, God alone is in charge of your future. Who can tell what will happen after him under the sun? Ouija boards? Yeah, remember those? Ouija boards, you put your hands on it. Horoscopes? Horror scopes. They'll tell you what you're supposed to be doing this day and that day? No. Jeannie Dixon? No. She knows better now. Nostradamus? No, he knows better too. But a lot of people follow what they say. None of them can know the future. Only God. God's in control of the future. Why? Well, because he's already determined it. Better get on this election thing. God's determined the future. So, stick close to him. He's the one in charge. And don't argue with him. That's futile. Now, conclusion. Solomon's closing points, I think, are a good closing for this message. God created us all to find meaning a certain way. The ultimate meaning is not found in money or vocation. The ultimate meaning is found in God alone. To argue with God about this arrangement is an exercise in futility.